session number 17129, reel 3.
Sad thing is, we weren't able to allowed to demonstrate the similar breakthrough with the TSR2, because that was beginning to show all the elements of the successful aerodynamics of its predecessors.
This is wing commander beam on reel 2. So we can go onto the Canberra now, and you can sort of expand possibly for me just what you've been saying about its tremendous performance.
Yes, well, it was an exciting time, 1949, when we started the flying of the B-345, or Canberra, as it now has been called. This was an aeroplane only slightly larger, really, than a Mosquito, designed largely to replace the Mosquito's type of light bomber activities, but to extend them very, very considerably. And we did the first flight in May 1949. Within 2 months, we were flying that aeroplane at 45,000 feet. And by the end of the year, we were flying it at 50,000 feet. And we realized then that that wasn't its ceiling. It was going to go well above that. The first series of Canberras, the B Mark IIs, by 1951, I'd taken one of the development aircraft at lightweight to 55,000 feet. That was approximately 15,000 feet above the maximum notional intercept height of the current Meteor, which was the standard RAF fighter at the time, and the same applied all over the world. Wherever the Canberra went, it was capable of flying 10,000 feet above the interception, and this had some interesting aspects. In 1951 or 2, the Americans decided that they wanted the Canberra for the U.S. Air Force. And we were charged with sending two over there as pattern aircraft. The Martin Aircraft Company at Baltimore had been selected to build Canberras under license, modified to suit the USAF's requirements. And in delivering one of them down the North American seaboard from Gander, Newfoundland, one day, I can't remember, I think it was in August, that's right, I found that there was a great deal of interest going on in the radio reporting points, and I was being asked to state your altitude, and I was replying, this is a British military aircraft, that's classified information, and they got very excited about that, and we realized that they were making us an interception exercise. Weather was clear, and as we approached New York, coming down Long Island, around about 50,000 feet, you could see crisscrossing contrails of fighters below us, which were most probably F-86s, which are the best fighters the Americans had, and they went a long way below us. And so I thought, well, we'll have some fun here, and we used the maximum climb rating for 5 minutes as we went over the top of New York, then finally throttled back and descended towards Baltimore, about 200 miles further along on Chesapeake Bay, landed there. And after the reception and the excitement and everything, I was told that we were wanted at the Pentagon the following morning. You see, I wasn't surprised, so I went down to the Pentagon, and I was ushered into a room full of generals covered in medal ribbons, and who were all very polite and interested about this new Canberra and what could I tell them about it. And it was all perfectly innocuous stuff. And then finally, one of the generals said, "And Sabine, what, you had some communication difficulties yesterday?" So I said, no difficulties, General, no problem at all." And he said, "Well, you weren't able to state your altitude to the reporting points from Maine down through Long Island over New York." And I said, "General, this is a British military aircraft, and that information is classified secret. I couldn't reveal it, you see." And there was a sort of pause, and then the general said, "Well, say, what was your actual altitude over New York?" And I said, 51,000 feet. And they all said, "Gee whiz," all round the table. And it was quite, story went round the American establishment for some years after that. But this was at a time when we were delivering a British aeroplane for the Americans to evaluate, which could in no way be intercepted by the great American defense system. They had no way of dealing with it. No missiles then, no fighters that could get up that high. And this was a measure of the big step forward had made. And of course,
what were the characteristics of the aircraft that gave it this performance? I mean, it had a huge wing area, didn't
yes,
it?
Low wing loading, relatively high power to weight ratio, excellent aerodynamics, which allowed it, even though it was a straight-wing aeroplane, it allowed it to achieve Mach limits of around about 0.86 as compared with the 0.79 of the Meteor. And that, coupled with the fact that there was no great breakthrough in new technology in it, it was all state-of-the-art technology, the systems were largely off-the-shelf items. The only new technology, in a sense, was that the engines were Rolls-Royce RA3 Avons, axial flow engines, they were, in fact, second-generation Rolls-Royce jet engines, with all the knowledge that had gone into the previous 5 or 6 years of development. The Canberra was probably one of the simplest and easiest aeroplanes you could imagine. We got used to the idea that if you wanted to fly anywhere in the world over stages up to about 2,500 miles, you just put the fuel in the aeroplane, did your flight bang, and went. It was the most reliable vehicle. It wasn't a highly complex, modern technology, difficult aeroplane to deal with. Very, very easy. And that's why, of course, 15 air forces around the world bought it. And it's still in service today. After its first flight in 1949, there are still Canberras flying around the world, and the Air Force still maintains a squadron of PR-9s. And we confidently expect them to be flying them in 1999, which will give it a 50-year operational service.
Now, when the Americans built it as the B-57, of course, they altered the cockpit to a tandem
yep.
system, didn't they? They also, I think I noticed in Jane's, developed a very large winged version for a spy
yes.
plane, I suppose.
Yes, that's
right.
It got
up to about 70,000 or so, did it?
Oh, a little over 70, yes, yeah. yes. Mm-hmm. The Americans did that rather better than we did. We did a version of the Canberra, the PR-9, with an extended centre section to increase the wing area, and RA-24 engines, which were basically the same engine as in the Lightning supersonic fighter, but without the reheat. And the operational intention of that was to clear it to 60,000 feet, but we didn't get there, and the new extended centre section of the wing actually produced more induced drag than was expected. So that wasn't quite as successful as the Americans. The Americans decided, right, this is a unique opportunity to make a really high altitude aeroplane, and they put a very, very big wing on. They used it very considerably in the Cold War period over Russia.
Because I think the RAF operated Canberras over Russia.
Oh, they did. Yes, we don't know about that, but they did.
Well, there was an article about it in the aeroplane I read.
That's right, yes, yes.
Declassified to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Now the other thing, the B-8 and the PR-9 were modified to have a sort of single pilot
right.
canopy. That presumably was again to reduce drag, was it?
No, there are two or three reasons. One was that to make it into a low altitude, deep penetration tactical aeroplane, ground attack aeroplane, with bombs or guns or rockets. It was thought it needed to have much more all-round vision than the ordinary pilot's cockpit in the B-2 camera, where you had a nice blister canopy to look forward and round you, but you couldn't look back. The B-8 was a raised cockpit with an all-round rear vision, which was quite an advantage. Latterly, with PR9 versions, they put an ejection seat in for the navigator forward of the pilot. The B-8 didn't have that facility, and so this was regarded as a rather bad feature. Yes, I think that the revised canopy on the Mark 8 did actually reduce the drag a little, improved the performance. It was certainly a much nicer aeroplane to fly.
From the visibility point of view, or from handling as well?
Handling wasn't affected. It was a bit quicker, you know, it would accelerate a bit quicker. No, I think that the all-round vision was a great improvement, and you felt it was better from that point of view.
Now, you did two transatlantic record runs in the Canberra, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
One way, and then there and back in a day.
That's right, yes.
As well, which hit the headlines quite a lot.
Yes.
The double crossing, was that done? You had to refuel at the other end, presumably, or did you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, we had to do that. Yes, well, we had an unrefueled capability of about 3,000 miles in the Mark 5 prototype, which we used for that flight. To Gander, it was about 1,900 nautical miles, so you certainly had to refuel. That came about not as a PR exercise, as is often thought. The B Mark V was the first of the Canberras with wet wings, that is, fuel tanks in the wings. And we were in the process of proving its performance by extended long-range cruises. And we'd been doing this round and round UK till it was getting rather boring. You know, you do it 3.5 hours from Land's End to John O'Groats and to Manston and back again, and you go round twice. And then we extended them out to the first weather station Charlie, I think, off the Irish coast somewhere. And then we thought that we would get some much more accurate fuel consumption over distance measurements if we actually did a very long, virtually straight stage. And the obvious thing to do was either do it to Malta or to across the Atlantic. And at that stage, somebody thought, well, if we did it across the Atlantic and we got a team over there to turn the aeroplane quickly and come straight back, this could then be the first time the Atlantic has ever been flown twice in one day, once in each direction. So that's what we did. So it was a test flight with a PR element, and it worked very well. In fact, we had a difficult decision on the morning, because we got up for a Met briefing at about 4 o'clock. They were showing us a jet stream on the nose over most of the way out, which is going to mean that our outward leg would take about 4.5 hours, which was slower than the previous record flight that had been done, or slower than my own flight when I come to think of it. But then when we studied it with the Met men, they quite correctly forecast that the jet stream would increase during the day. It wouldn't vary in direction, and if we got into it, if we found it on the way out and could plot it, and we got right into the middle of it, it would help us tremendously on the way back. And the return leg of that trip was done in about 3 hours 15 minutes from Newfoundland to Belfast, which, apart from being a startlingly quick time in those days, it included averaging about 600 miles an hour true speed for about two-thirds of the flight, with 100 knots of wind on the tail. Quite interesting.
And you could fly cruise climb, I suppose, on that.
Yes, that's what we did. Yes. But much easier way. There was much argument that cruise climb would be a difficult thing to do, that the pilot, without an autopilot — we didn't have an autopilot on that particular aeroplane — manually flying, holding height for hours on end, height and speed, would be much easier than doing a cruise climb. In fact, it's the other way around. If you do a cruise climb, all you do is fly the Mach number and let the weight organise the height. So all you have to do is to fly one particular instrument. And in the case of that flight, we were cruising at Mach 0.74, and from the top of the climb at about 43,000 feet, we just set 0.74 on the Mach number, reduced the power to max continuous cruise, and then just let the airplane drift up as it consumed fuel. So we ended up at the top of the climb before descending to Gander at around about 48,000 feet. A very easy way to do it, actually.
And you carried, what, two navigators with you, or...?
No, just one.
Just one.
Mm-hmm. No, we the first trip that we did, delivering one over there, we carried three people, including Rodney. No, not Rodney. Chap called Dryland is not his first name wasn't Rodney. We carried him. He was a Marconi engineer, and we got a trial installation Marconi radio compass in it, and we carried it purely for him to operate the radio compass. And it packed up about 50 miles out of Aldergrove, so he had a long ride for nothing.
Of course, another version, they fitted one of the Canberras with Olympus engines, didn't they? And
that's right.
To about 60,000 feet, didn't they, Walter Gibb flew it?
Yes, Walter Gibb did 63,000, I think, in the Olympus prototype. And then Mike Randrup did 71,000 in the... or about 70,000 in a Canberra modified with Napier Scorpion rocket engines. That was a remarkable flight, actually.
So you were on a period of continuous testing of the Canberra as all the various production models went through.
Mm-hmm.
And your flight test team presumably increased. You had a team of...
We started off at Wharton in 1947 with Johnny Squire, who was the resident production test pilot at English Electric, and myself. And by the time we'd got through to the 1964, which was the end of the first 4 years of flight development on the Canberra and the beginning of the P1 testing, we had a team of about 12 test pilots. And at our peak, when we were churning out Lightnings for the RAF, Canberras for overseas air forces, and starting the testing of TSR2, we had a flight test team of about 14 test pilots and four flight test observer navigators. Almost a squadron, really.
Amazing. Now, at what point did the Lightning program or the P1 program start to come in?
Well, the P1 concept started in 1948 when Teddy Petter, leading English Electric, decided to challenge the government ruling to opt out of supersonic development. If you remember, in 1947 they cancelled the Miles M52 transonic development aeroplane, which undoubtedly would have done just that, and they just cancelled it. They said that they had no further interest in transonics, but they would carry out a limited research program with rocket vehicles from the West Country. Well, we believed that was a waste of public money, and that we, the British, should stay in. And we had a lot of deep discussions. Ray Creasy, the chief aerodynamicist at Wharton, Di Ellis, another aerodynamics expert who designed our first supersonic wind tunnel, Teddy Petter, and myself, throughout 1948, on the idea that we would put forward a design study for a supersonic fighter, which would actually be based first on a supersonic research vehicle, which could be developed into a fighter without any major difficulties. We lobbied the ministry. We got a number of people from the establishment. Morian Morgan was one from the Aeroflight at Farnborough on our side. And by the end of 1948, Teddy Petter had obtained from the ministry an undertaking that they would be producing a project study for a supersonic aeroplane, and that we would hear about it. In 1949, we were scheming the P-1 already by then. In 1949, we received a contract under the project number. I'm just trying to remember what it was. No, it's gone.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was we were given a contract to develop this P-1, two flying prototypes and a structural test vehicle, F-349, that was it, and we were away. At the same time, a contract was placed on ferries to produce the FD-2 Delta solution to the supersonic project idea. The English Electric one involved the then very exotic breakthrough of 60 degree leading edge wing sweep with a shoulder wing and a low, very thin tailplane. Ferries were going to produce a thin all Delta aeroplane, which was regarded again as very exotic. And whether they were ever contracted to produce a fighter development of it, I don't know, but they certainly were going to produce a research version of it. P-1 first flew in 1954, and the FD-2 flew either in the end of 52 or 54 or early 55. It was a bit after us. They were both successful aerodynamically. The P-1 was flown to Mach 1 on its third flight, which was fairly rapid development rate, and it proved everything that was hoped of it. It was a remarkably easy aeroplane to fly, despite its exotic configuration. I mean, 60 degrees of wing sweep was way out in those days. Nobody had ever seen an aeroplane like that before, and there were lots of dark theories about how it would become unmanageable and its stability would be questionable and so on. It turned out to be absolutely first class.
And the ailerons are effectively on the wingtip.
That's right. Yeah. Fully power controlled, irreversible power controlled. First British aeroplane to have irreversible power controls. And we had, I remember having a rig up at Wharton with these power controls on it, where they tailored the artificial responses to the pilot requirement. And I just said how much force I was prepared to accept there and so on, until they finally honed it to exactly as this particular pilot wanted it. And that's how we flew it, and it was absolutely first class. It was a great experience, the P-1, because we did regard it as a potentially quite an exciting beast. It turned out to be very docile, very easy to fly, providing you changed your sights a bit. And when you were used to doing a final approach in a camber style of aeroplane or a Meteor at about 90 or 100 knots, in this aeroplane you were doing your final approach at 180 and touching down to about 150. So it was a bit faster. But all that really meant was that you needed a bit more runway to land it on.
You had a braking parachute.
Brake parachute, yes. Oh, yes, it could become an embarrassment if you tried to land it on a conventional runway in the rain and the brake parachute failed. That was quite exciting. I had that happen on a Farnborough display once, and I ended up dodging the approach lighting posts on the Laffin's plane approach end of the airfield, luckily without damage.
Now, you presumably, I mean, it was the same sort of pattern. The mock-up was built, and you were in at the beginning on the shape.
That's right.
The
yes.
Cockpit layout. And,
one of the things that was interesting about that was that with this very highly swept wing and highly loaded wing, it was going to have a very high attitude angle of attack. In its landing configuration, all swept wing aeroplanes have this. You watch them on the approach, and it's always a very nose high approach. Well, this was going to be higher than we'd ever seen before, And so in the design you had to take that into consideration in allowing the pilot view of the runway. So what would you do as the nose came up on the approach? How are you going to maintain vision of the runway? If you put the seat up, you had a higher cockpit and windscreen. That meant more drag, which wasn't acceptable supersonically. So you had to devise ways and means of doing it. On the P1, this was answered by taking basically a circular intake for the airflow into the two engines, which were one on top of the other, over and under, and the top decking of the nose was flattened or sloped, so that the pilot could see on either side of it. Couldn't see directly ahead on the approach, but could see on either side. That was all worked out with a wooden mock-up, which was stuck on the back of a lorry and taken out onto our runway at Wharton, and then I sat in there defining what these minimum angles were, and the actual designer was there to make chalk marks on the cardboard and wood mock-up. All very basic stuff, but it worked.
Now the transition from the P1, and there was the P1A and the P1B before you finally developed it into the Lightning.
Right. The contract for this program was started in 1949. By 1953, the design of the P1 was going so well that we were able to show confidence to the ministry that we had the fighter development on the drawing boards, and we showed them what we proposed to do, which was to basically use the P1 airframe from the bulkhead aft of the cockpit, almost unchanged, but from the cockpit bulkhead forwards, there would be a new cockpit, slightly raised with a bit more view and improved sideways and rearward vision. That the nose would be totally rounded. We would get past this a vision problem by raising the seat a bit, which we now found we could do because the drag wasn't apparently going to be a problem. And the centre of the intake would contain a sharp pointed bullet fairing for the weapon system radar, AI-23. This was all schemed in 1953. By 54, it had been pretty well finalised, and about that time, I can't remember the exact date, English Electric received a production contract for the developed P1B, as it was called. First of all, I think there were 20 prototypes and development aircraft, and then a final production run for the Royal Air Force. That program began in 54. So did the test flying program on the P1. The test flying program was so free of trouble and so straightforward. I said we achieved Mark 1 on the third flight and 1.1 something or other on the fourth flight. By a year later, we'd achieved Mark 1.5 on it. It was only actually initially designed to do 1.1, so it was going ahead very fast. Beautiful to fly, no stability or control problems. We had a rudder flutter problem, which we had to cure, and some undercarriage problems, but basically it was straightforward. On the basis of that, there was enormous confidence on the fighter development. The first one, the P-1B, flew in May 1957, and that was taken up to Mark 1.1 on its first flight, straight up, straight supersonic. That was an entirely successful aeroplane. That particular aeroplane, the same one, the first prototype, P1B, reached Mark 2 a year later. And aerodynamically and control-wise, the P1 series were superlatively good. There was fine tuning to be done here and there. We had no major problems until we got to the. We had a lot of systems engineering problems, fires, hydraulic fires, and things like that. But they were ironed out. We had no major aerodynamic problems until the trainers, which were side by side variants. The T4 was the first, the T5 the second. And each one of these, this is a long story which we haven't got time to talk about now, each one of these had catastrophic failures. The first, the T4, had a fin collapse at high Mach number in a roll coupling exercise. And despite drastic redesign and strengthening, when 3 years later the T5 variant flew, that was lost in almost the same way. The fin came off during high.
Both got out,
yes. And both injured. Johnny Squire had the first one, and he had a remarkable escape. He ejected over the Irish Sea at supersonic speed at around about 35,000 feet. It was a misty October evening, and the Air Sea Rescue organization failed to find him, and they said they would continue to search during the night, doing a SARA search. That's operating with a SARA beacon, which was supposed to be transmitting from the chap in the dinghy. Following day, they hadn't found him. By 24 hours after the accident, he'd been given up for lost. 27 hours after the accident, he climbed ashore over the rocks at West Frew.
He paddled ashore.
Yeah, he paddled ashore. And he said the worst moment of the whole performance was that when he was in sight of the rocks, and he knew he couldn't swim, and how the hell was he going to get out of this dinghy into the rocks? And he nearly drowned in the last 100 yards.